So you don't just build a product or you don't just build a service, but you build a mentality, a mindset, a way of working, and a network of people like that, so you can continue generation after generation to do that. To me, that's your soul. I don't believe in the ethereal soul. I believe your soul is what you plant in each person on this planet, and they remember you even when you're gone, and they live and take those things that you imparted to them and build on top of it and instill it into the next generations and the next generations and the next generations. That is a person's soul.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Gervais, by trade and training, a high performance psychologist. And today, I'm excited to sit with Tony Fadell. Tony is an entrepreneur, designer, engineer, an investor with 30-year history of founding companies and designing some of the most influential products of the 20th century. And that is not an easy feat. We're going to understand how that happens, who he is, the principles that live just underneath the surface of how he's made choices in his life. And Tony, I've been following you from your in your work from a distance. I've been consuming just about all of the products I think that you've made. And I'm really excited to sit with you.
Michael, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited for this conversation and hopefully your audience gets something out of it. I'm really, really, really anxious to be on.
I think that is that what you just said. I hope somebody gets, you know, something out of it. I feel like that is right at the heartbeat of your purpose right now. Is passing a baton is a phrase that I read in your book that's meaningful to you. And so you have been wildly successful in your career, but it's clear that it didn't happen overnight, in your words. And you've held significant leadership positions across at least 7 different companies that I'm aware of. And then you sold one of them, a small little project called Nest, to Google for multiple billions. I mean, my hope for this conversation is really to better understand how you organize your inner life, how you develop vision. Yeah, how you develop a vision. So maybe we can start with this idea of failures and successes. How do you define success? Big question, I understand. But I'm equally interested in how you operationalize and define failure. So let's start with those two big, heavy topics.
Okay. Big, heavy. So how do we define success? Well, I think success is, first, it starts with a mission. So, you have to have a mission focus to be able to then drive yourself and drive others to get behind something that's big and bold and meaningful. So I don't think of success as just making money. You know, people can define it by numbers. I define it on a mission that's going to change the world in some constructive, positive way. That's the way I think of success. And if you get there, the money follows, and the money follows 10x or 100x more than you could ever expect. So instead of chasing money, chase a mission that's worth chasing, and then people will join you along the way. So for me, it's reaching that the conclusion of the mission. I don't think the mission, if it's a really well-defined one, ever ends. But, you know, it usually takes about 10 years to realize the mission that I'm on to truly bring impact. And then we create a culture or whatever, and that can follow on even if I'm not involved in it anymore. So for me, success is really, you know, getting to that mission and that mission objective, even if it slightly changes over time. But that's what I like to see. Now, when it comes to failure is the only way we really learn. Okay. So if we understand how we are educated and how we grow up, for the most part, when we grow up, we go to school, we're told, here's the things you need to learn. Read these things, take these tests, and you either pass or fail. It is a very, very much prescriptive, process-driven thing, and that is how your brain is trained in your most formative years, which is unfortunate. Because in fact, you learned to walk and talk before you learned to go to school and follow that process. And how did you learn to walk and talk? by failing thousands of times. When you wanted to walk, you failed 1,000 times before walking. And you know what? You had an environment around you saying, I encourage you. Yes, go for it. You just stood up for 1 second. Yeah, you fell down. Oh, keep trying, keep trying. And you have an environment who supports failure and understands that the way you're going to learn is by doing and failing and keep trying till you have success. Same thing with language. So now all of a sudden we put kids in schools and they're told, this is the way you do it. And if you pass, you pass. And if you fail, you fail. And there's no other way around that. I think that's utterly wrong, because as soon as you get out in the real world, you're back to do, fail, learn, do, fail, learn. And you only truly fail in life is if you don't take the next step to learn through the failure and continue to keep going. So failure is only when you stop pursuing whatever you're curious on, because for whatever reason, you can pivot. You can obviously pivot and when you learn and change your direction, but you keep going, right? It's when you stop and you just say, ah, I've given up. I failed too many times. I'm not going to get there. You can always modulate and figure out a new way. And that doesn't mean you're going to do the same thing, but it means you're going to pick yourself up and find the next big mission to go on, even if the last one failed. So to me, we have to understand failure is the best way to learn, and it's the only way to learn in life. Because if you're doing anything innovative, there are no experts. There are people with experience that you can bring on your team, but there are no experts for innovating to change our planet, our societies, our health in the world, because you're by definition doing something the world's never seen before.
Mm. There's so much embedded in what you just talked about from a psychological lens. There's obviously resilience and perseverance and vision and purpose and. So one of the things maybe I would love to unpack just a little bit is on, if I understand it correctly, you're saying success is made by making or being on a mission. You don't necessarily have to make the mission. You could be on a mission. Correct. And so is that fair to say? Because you have created your missions and you're correct, very clear about it for you. But that would mean that if you're employing, let's say 500 people, that the other 500s, if they're in service in some way of your mission, that wouldn't be success. That I know that I'm being pedantic, but that's not.
Yeah. So let's get into it. Look, Every time you add another person to the team, they can further that mission. They are part of it. They need to own the mission just as much as the leader might. In fact, you as a leader, a great leader gives the mission over to everyone to make it better. So as a leader, you need to have more details. And these are the people that you bring on because they are in service of this, what starts to be a very vague mission at the beginning. And then it becomes better and better defined at how you implement the strategies and tactics behind that mission. And maybe the mission grows and becomes even bolder over time. So the people that you bring on to help you with the mission need to have agency and ownership of that mission. It can't just be, I have this idea. This is what we're going to do. Now you follow my lead. Sure, there is some of that, but you have to let each of those people own it at their very core and bring the best of themselves, because what they want to do is they also want to learn. They're curious. They want to do what we're wanting to do, but we don't have all the details understood. And that's the reason why you build teams and you go and root out all of this uncertainty to be able to make a stronger mission and a stronger culture behind that mission.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Let's pull apart agency and ownership for just a minute, because let's look at it that in two different lenses. One lens, which is a shoestring budget, kind of an early startup, sure, right? Mm-hmm. And then another one is like ledger money, where you're well-funded and you've got rich resources. Okay, so on agency, it's such a great word. And it means that somebody feels powerful in themselves, right? They feel like they can get something done. The tension with ownership. So people want agency. And actually, mm-hmm, I should say it better. Like, we all have agency at our core. And the old way of doing business, tell me if you think I'm off on this, was I'm going to empower you to have agency, which makes me nauseous. What do you mean you're going to empower me? You know, and I don't say that, I guess it sounded arrogantly, but it's meant to almost be like, have a rough edge. Like, I have a sense of power. I want to express it. I want to share my gifts and talents and skills with this mission, with you. So I don't need you to empower me. What I need you to do is help me create a runway so I can do my thing. Okay, so hold on. I'm getting lost in my narrative here. Is that the old way is that I'm going to empower you so that you can do your best work. And what you said is like, you said, no. People, I want them to work from agency and ownership. But agency is like, I feel powerful. And ownership is like, I own something.
Correct.
So sometimes the two of those are, I own the mission, I own this part of the mission. Sometimes, sure, those two things struggle together because of accountability. So I would love for you to talk about agency and accountability, because if you're the founder, you're on the hook.
Right.
You have full account. You probably leveraged your home and your children's mortgage or your children's education. Fill in the blanks for all the dramatic things that we could say, but you're on the hook.
Right.
You've got the loan in your name. So how do you help? How do you help build that accountability?
Well, first, people normally, this is what I've seen, is they sign up for that accountability because they care about the mission so deeply that they want to see it succeed. So they're accountable to something higher than just me. They're accountable mm-hmm. to something that they want to see exist, and the people around them want to see exist. So they're also accountable to their peers. So they watch each other and they pull each other up and they help each other. So through this kind of peer network and leadership network, everybody is rising themselves up to the best standards they can because they don't want to let the other person down, whether that's the leader or the other people aside of them, as well as the mission. So it's this kind of very tight bundling, right? And you've probably seen it in many of the things that you've seen in the past. When you build a small team, we're all in this together. Okay. Yeah. And sure, yeah. there's someone who has the checkbook or is paying, but remember, as a leader, I got to also worry about them and their families.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And right. so I always have to go back. We're on this mission, but I also know that you're on this mission for yourself, but you also have to take care of your family. And the more I recognize that and more I say that we need to do the right thing by not just you, but by your family, that shows that we're all in this together. And acknowledging the spouse when you're away from the family because you're working so hard, or the kids or whatever, and making sure that the spouse and the family feels a part of it as well, so that it becomes this movement, not just a job. Okay, so that's what I mean by that. Now, the other thing is we have to also understand that when you have agency and ownership, we have to understand what decisions you can actually make as an individual because of your purview, but also what you have to understand that you're going to give opinions to and data to someone who's making opinion-based decisions. Because when you're doing something new, usually a lot of those decisions are opinion-based. And you can't all of a sudden bring together all these people with all these opinions and try to blend them all. Because then what you get is blah. Because it's always compromise. And everyone's compromising and getting around and it's political. And everyone's like, oh, I want to be heard and I want to be heard. You still have to understand that even if you have a mission and you're giving people agency, that those people understand when you're making opinion-based decisions, it sometimes needs to come from one person or a small team of people who hold that vision and can help keep the opinion-based decisions congruent with all the other ones so that it comes out in service of the mission for the customer at hand that you're trying to meet. So the team understands that we're working on this together, but certain decisions, even though they own certain pieces, they're not going to own necessarily the end decision because it's an opinion-based decision that needs to be made by a small group of people saying, which way are we going? And they can explain why we're going that way and explain the logic behind the way they made that opinion-based decision.
So I hear you repeat the idea of an opinion-based decision. Is that your engineer mind? Or is that you speaking to engineers saying, listen, I don't have the data to support what I'm doing. This is my opinion based on gut. It's like another way of you saying, listen, I recognize that data is important, but right now this is a general opinion that I'm trying to narrow down for direction.
Exactly. That mm-hmm. is exactly what it is. And I want each person to give their opinion and also the data that might refute that opinion. Their opinion or my opinion. But at the end of the day, we can't have a group of people all agree on one opinion because everyone's going to come from different things. All you can do is make that decision and then explain it to people. And if people don't agree with it, they can leave the team. But most people get behind it if you can do a good job of explaining why this matters for the mission and for the customer. Because if you're doing anything innovative, you're not going to be able to get data until after you've given it to the customer who's paid for it, who's shown that there's an exchange of value when they can give real feelings about what it is you're making.
Did you have this clarity before you and your team built the iPod and before you built the iPhone and before you built Nest? Or has this come on reflection post?
So if we go all the way back to General Magic, this was in the 1990s. There's a movie all about it. It was a huge failure. It was the biggest failure. We were trying to create the iPhone 15 years too early. There were lots of opinions and we were doing things, but they were not grounded in enough reality for us to be able to have the right way to think about what we were building. Okay. We were just building for building's sake. We weren't thinking about the customer. We had a grand arching vision of pleasing ourselves, but we didn't know who was going to buy because we just said, oh, we like it. Everyone's going to buy. So through that failure, that incredible failure, and I encourage everybody to watch General Magic the movie. It's really a lesson in failure and redemption. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's where it started for me, and that's where I get sensitized to really understanding opinion-based decisions and the why behind products. And then I at Philips, I did it again, and then and got better and better at audience and understanding messaging. Then at Apple, I really saw the mastery of Steve Jobs and the storytelling, the non-fictional storytelling, and the delivery of a customer experience. And then we put it into full display at Nest. And we were very, very clear about the opinion-based decisions, the customer journey, the storytelling, all of those things, and the bonding of marketing to the product design at the very earliest days, so that we would not make the mistakes I saw over, you know, the early years of my career.
Okay. Did you learn mission there? Did you learn the mistakes of not having clarity of mission there?
At General Magic, I learned mission. I learned mission, but we were focused on the what at General Magic, not the why and the who. So what was just making more technology for technology's sake and impressing ourselves and the geek next to us. We had all kinds of crazy ideas because we were literally making the iPhone 15 years too soon, but there was no internet yet. There was no even mobile communication. There was no mobile phones for the most part. There was no, there was almost not even laptops. So, or mobile entertainment or downloadable games or emojis, or most people didn't even have email. So we were making things because the geeks in us knew what the future would be. We didn't know why we were making it or who we were making it for and why would they want to buy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What a magical time. Like that must have been awesome. It's a little bit like, you know, I imagine what it would be like in Mission Control putting the first person on the moon. And I was fortunate to be in Mission Control supporting Felix Baumgartner, which is now the 10-year anniversary of Felix jumping from outer space.
Wow, it's amazing. 10 years already. That's crazy.
10 years. So that type of electric, you know, bright minds coming together with a very clear mission where somebody's life was on the line. And you guys were just like, in your words, a bunch of geeks and nerds, like trying to build something to impress each other. And it must have been just awesome. You know who we had on? We had on Megan Smith.
Megan's awesome. Yeah. She was there 6 months before I got there. And so we were like, in General Magic, the movie, she's there in it. Like, it's amazing.
Oh, dynamite is a great word for Megan. She's so electric. And I mean, look what she ended up doing with the rest of her career. Look at what most of you did. Look. Okay. So I got to understand what was in the water at that time. Was it accidental that you guys got together, or was there somebody that had a mission to put the brightest nerds, the hardest working nerds, whatever it might be? Nerds is not the word you use geeks. Like, what was that mission about?
So what we were about was, this was the Macintosh team. So literally the original Macintosh team, Andy Hertzfeld, Bill Atkinson, Joanna Hoffman, Susan Kerr, and a whole cast of characters said, what is beyond the Mac? Mark Perrette was there and he came from Apple. And so it was all of these incredibly brilliant minds who created the Macintosh, minus Steve, and said, we're going to go build the next platform, the next thing that's going to change the world. Okay, it was going to be something handheld. It was, you know, furthering the Dynabook concept from Alan Kay in the 80s, which was like the early tablets. You know, he had this idea of education on a tablet. And so they wanted to build this thing. And so they attracted all the smartest minds around Silicon Valley that they knew, and they, you know, and they had an underground network, because remember, there was no internet, there was no LinkedIn, there was none of this stuff. So they all like got together, and I, through reading the rumor pages of Mac Week and Mac World magazine, heard about this team forming, and I went and had to go knock on the door, send letters, do everything I possibly could for 6 months, 9 months to get into that company.
You weren't in. So you were the young kid.
I was the youngest. I was the youngest for a while there.
Okay. Did you always, Did you always have this fire that you have in this call?
Always.
This is you.
This is me. You. You know, okay. Rule breaker. I was the kid who was getting thrown out all the time. I wouldn't just take no for an answer. I would always push.
15 schools in 17 years. Is that right?
12 schools in 15 years.
Jesus. So you know about people. You know about figuring out how to make a new relationship. Did you reinvent your time?
You know how to be a chameleon.
That's right. You know how to fit in. Yeah, I know that. I moved a bunch too. And so like my parents would move me in the middle of school years. Like
me too.
Okay. So rule breaker, physical risk taker, like, or is it more in social?
Well, I wouldn't say risk taker in terms of real or physical, like mountain climbing or free mm-hmm. climbing, like, right? I'll do stuff like I'll go on intense bike rides, long road bikes and mountain bikes and all that other stuff. But I wouldn't say overly intense, like you're extreme. That's
yeah,
not me.
Right. Okay, got it.
But for mm-hmm. me, really what it was about was after you saw enough clicks in schools, you probably remember this. You saw enough clicks, you're like, and you moved around enough. You're like, screw that. I'm just going to be me. And I was also a geek. So I was also, you know, Revenge of the Nerds, right? In the 80s, they weren't celebrated like they are today. So mm-hmm. I was always the outcast, the weird kid, the new kid. And so you really steeled yourself around watching each of these cultures, these subcultures inside of a school, whether that was in Texas or New York or wherever it was, Michigan. And you just said, okay, at some point you're like, I'm going to be me. And if you don't like me, screw you. I still got beat up. I still was this, but I just hunkered down and was the kid who just did what he wanted to do. And people were jealous that I might be smart some days or I said shit that shouldn't be said because I didn't care about being part of the group. I didn't care about running with the gang.
So you sound like you were bullied.
Oh yeah, from time to time, for sure.
Okay, how did that shape you? I mean, that's awful.
You didn't go about building strong connections, right? Because you knew you were gonna move on and you knew that typically those people wanted you to conform with whatever way they were living. Right. You're going to tuck in. There's the gang member, the gang leader. And then you were going to, whether that it wasn't a real gang, you know, I was never in that kind of situation. But, you know, those little cliques, the clique mm-hmm. leader and that. And I just wouldn't do that. I just wouldn't follow those rules because I could never stay long enough to earn anybody's trust. Right. Because if you're there a year, you have to be there a couple of years, especially as the kids got older, because they're like, oh, should we let them in or not? Right. Or they want you to test you out or play with you. So literally, it was those groups always coming after the new kid or the geeky kid or the smart kid. And so at mm-hmm. some point, you just give up and say, screw it, I'm just going to be me. And then I would rebel, you know, to my teachers. I would be the kid who would always ask too many questions and everybody hated, right? Like, oh, he's asking another question. So I just didn't care at some point about my relationships with people I didn't care about. I did care about certain relationships with certain people. Like, I hung out with a lot more girls than I did with guys because I was much more in touch with certain sides of myself that were much more about like, oh, why don't we just have a discussion? Why do we always have to have a competition? Da, da, da. And so naturally I had all of these girl as friends, not girlfriends, but girls as friends who I could resonate more with than typically the guys.
Okay. I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here. Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, with chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to Hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydro.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. Okay. Do you work more from your head or your heart?
Both. It's always both. I'm have to be okay. A blend of both.
So you have that animus side, the male, masculine, feminine energy about you. Like you can access your head and your heart.
Yeah, I think guys don't have anywhere near enough feminine energy and they should tap into it. Right. So and I think I love women who have more masculine energy because then that empowers them and they don't get suppressed, right, by the male domination. So I like people who are much more balanced, whereas guys, that's not me. I can't go and sit there and drink beer and watch sports 24/7 and that is just not me.
That is so funny. Okay, and it is because it feels too surface or because there's not enough emotional stimulation.
There's not enough emotion stimulation. There's not enough learning. It's the same thing over and over. I'm like, what am I learning here? I'm just watching more people compete. I don't care about somebody's sports career, especially inside of a team and then their egos and everything else. I care about what are you doing for the world? What can I learn? So I like individual sports to a certain extent, but only to a certain extent. But I'd much rather prefer non-fictional books, learning, curiosity, and tapping in things that can make me be better by learning through people, not watching just outright entertainment for entertainment's sake. To me, that's diversionary and it doesn't build me up. It actually makes me weaker.
You know, this is going to sound surprising maybe to you. I really relate with that. I don't watch sport on the weekend. I love watching people because this is the industry that I'm in. So I love what sport provides for it to be a working laboratory. So do the arts. So does business. There's many working laboratories of how do people together become their very best. And what are the methodologies and the principles and the practices for that? So sport is like this very mechanical working laboratory. And so I don't watch sport. I watch my friends that I've been able to, you know, get to know along the way. And I watch, you know, the athletes that I've been fortunate enough to work with. And I love that. That feels, when you watch somebody
that's friends and risking, you're cheering them on and you're doing all that. But the business of sport, all that other stuff, I think I'd much rather see, I like it when the kids are like, kids are doing sport and you're like helping them and mentoring them and they see all the human factors and dynamics and overcoming their own issues. I love it when people are growing themselves inside of something as opposed to something that's, you know, business driven and those kinds of things. So I do like sport, but in a different context.
I would not have imagined that you would be more people focused than idea focused, because I mean, think about what you've done. Well, I don't need to say that. I'm thinking about what you've done. iPhone, iPod, Nest. Those are massively disruptive, meaningful products. And I would have thought you're an idea person to engineer to execution. And I hear you saying, no, it's really about relationships and people, which is refreshing and surprising to me.
If you don't make products in service of people and killing pain that the people have, it's not doing any good. So you have to understand people, their problems, their hopes, their dreams, and everything to take the technology, the ideas you have, and make sure they'll meet the needs, meet the people where they're at, the customers where they're at, to solve those pains and hopefully give them superpowers. So you need to have deep understanding of the technology, and you have to have deep understanding of people and how to make the two connect. Too many times geeks, like we were doing in Germany, we are making it for other geeks. And then when we try to connect it to the real world, it fell flat. People were like, oh, that's neat, but I don't think I need it. I don't know what it does for me, because they didn't have the pain. Fast forward 15 years later, when iPhone came out, they had the pain. At least a certain set of people in the world had that pain. And we solved for that pain and gave them a superpower. And they're like, oh my God, you got to try this. So if you don't have both halves of that equation, people and technology and ideas to make them, forget it. It's going to fall flat.
This is why you use technology, I'm using psychology. You use people where they work or maybe not, because I think your later products were for people outside of the business world, like Nest, you know, et cetera. But so you use technology, I'm using psychology, and you're using where people work and I'm using sport. And so meet people where they sweat or meet people where they have a pain or where they need. It feels really organic. And it's refreshing to hear you say that. I did not know that part about you, for sure. It didn't jump out.
And that was developed over time because of failure, because every single time, why did the product land flat? It wasn't because we didn't have good technology or, you know, General Magic we didn't, but because it was too big a vision. But at Philips, we did the right thing, but we didn't have the right messaging and marketing and sales, but we delivered a good product. It's just about, you know, and it was just this process of unfolding and understanding that, look, you can work as hard as you want, but if you really don't connect with the person on the other side, the early adopters for sure, maybe not the late adopters, but the early adopters, and hit them where they are and really speak to them, you're gonna waste 4, 5, 10 years of your life in something. So I wanted to make sure we were connecting and doing something that was successful, because we were on a mission to help, not just a mission to impress ourselves with cool technology like we were at General Magic. And so that mission continued on for 15 years, and then it ultimately came out as the iPhone, right? I was a DJ back in the 90s, and I really cared about music. And if you know about being a DJ, if you've ever been a DJ, you have to be, to have the dance floor going, you really need to have the vibe of that audience. And you need to know what the next thing is on. You can't just put what you want on. You got to have just enough to stretch them from where they are musically, not just always give them the hits, because you're going to wear them out, because they're like, I heard that again. Michael Jackson yet again? No. You got to stretch them just enough so that they get out of comfort zone to something they can go with and something they can still dance to and have that emotion, right? So a DJ, if you haven't done it, it's so incredibly stressful. You can't just put on a playlist and go, because that's not the vibe of the room. You have to read the vibe. And so when it came to the iPod, you know, 1,000 songs in your pocket, 10,000 songs in your pocket, it was about taking that love of music and putting it in a factor that people could be their own DJs, because they had all their music with them at any one time, and then they could figure it out, and making sure you connected that way. So you always have to have these blends between the things, because at the end of the day, your audience is your audience, and how are you performing for them, whether it's just putting on a track or is creating a product. It's all a product or a service in service of an audience that you're trying to bring forward, trying to grow, whether that's their musical knowledge or the superpowers in their hands. Those are the things that are so fundamental in our relationships in this world of delivering products or services.
Okay. So you've used two words, mission and vision. And I think this might be one of your superpowers, is that you know how to build them. You know how to clarify and communicate them. And then you said that the vision was too big at one point. So that's a little perplexing to me.
Okay.
That vision is too big. But I don't want to get lost on that. I do want to know, as I'm listening and learning, it's like, oh God, like, you know how to build missions. So how do you build a mission?
So vision, when you're making something really big, you're going to have a vision.
Wait, hold on, a 10 or 20 year vision.
Okay.
Tony, what's the laugh?
But if you tell people your 20 year vision, you'll scare most people out of their wits and they go, this person is crazy.
Oh, okay. Is that the laugh you just had? Like I love the laugh, but you're like, oh God, here we go. What is the laugh? Is it because this is so clear for you, or is it like?
Yeah, I've had so many times where you see people, and I get this all the time from entrepreneurs. They won't tell me their vision because they're worried that they're going to scare the person on the other side. I scared people too, because you have such a big mission. You're like, I'm going to do this and this and this. And then investors go, you're going to need billions of dollars for that. It's going to take years. I'm not investing in this crazy person. I want to make sure I see the next step. So you have to put it in chunks that most people will be, how can I say, enthusiastic about and engaged in, but not so far that you're crazy. They think you're crazy and they're like, I can't follow this guy. I'm going to go follow him in, you know, into running into a brick wall. Like, he's psychotic in a way. But you need to have that big vision, but you need to parcel it out over time. And you do that with, you know, missions in between. So the vision's there, and then there's phases, and each phase is a different mission along the route.
There you go. Okay. So when you think about vision, do you literally, when I think about it, it's like another word for when I use my imagination and think about the future state that I want to create, that's how I think about vision. And it's not about what's probable, it's more about what's possible. And so it's correct. This thing, it's a through line, you know, to this other world that I'm imagining could be.
Okay. It's your North Star. It's your North Star, and you're going to have waypoints along the way, right? But you want to make sure you're not focused right here. You want to make sure you're focused up here and that you're building along that route. Now, it's obviously going to diverge. It's not a straight line. You're going to go and change, and you're going to adapt, and maybe you're going to change your vision a little bit when you get more data. When you ship something and you see it, we're going to change this a little bit. Or maybe the landscape has changed slightly and you got to change it, right? But you want a much bolder vision so you can it drives you, but you want missions along the route that's going to help you to get there.
Perfect. Okay.
Now on the mission, though, let's talk about the mission specifically.
Yes.
How do you figure the mission you want to be? All right. To me, it all starts with, where's the pain? What is painful? If you start with pain, and there are new technologies, like there's pain that's always been there. If there are new technologies to address that pain, then you might have a new novel thing that you can create, because the technology affords you new advantages, new ways of looking at the problem to solve the problem, to solve that pain in a new way so that you can remove that. So there's a lot of times we have lots of pain. Let's say you're creating you created a product 15, 20 years ago. And you're like, oh, it was all this great, but there was a couple things not right yet with the technology, but it was good enough. And those users tried it. And they're like, yeah, the first 3 weeks were horrible, but I got through it, but it gave me some, it solved a problem for me. But I still have to deal with those few problems each day, but I've habituated them away, saying, oh, this is what I have to do to get this. Okay. Think of the transition from text-based computing to the Macintosh, graphical computing. People are like, oh, this is what I got to do. And then graphical came away because there was enough processing and graphics and all that. And like, oh my God, it's so much better. So what happens is when the Mac came, it was, look, yes, you want to do all this computing, but you want to make it easier. You want to be able to train people faster on it. You want to see things. You don't want to just have to imagine it because you're texting, you know, you're text creating it. So boom, that happened. So that was a major advantage. But people, when they were just before they saw the Mac, they were like, this is how we do spreadsheets. And this is how we do, you know, data processing and stuff. Really textual, very hard to learn and not for everybody. Then when the Mac comes, it goes, remember all those command lines? Remember all that stuff? Look at this new world. And people go, yes, that's what I want. So they might be doing similar things, but they're doing it differently. And it gives them a new superpower. And you've reminded them, like, the drudgery of the computing-based, you know, command line things. You see what I mean? So it's that kind of mental shift you have, and you remind people of the problems they have, and you create a new world for them to say, those problems will go away, and now you have a new way of interacting with the world.
So you've been in the world for just over 5 decades. What do you think the pain that most people feel is? How are you thinking through that?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of pains. You know, we have climate crisis now, where most people are finally waking up to it. So we have to deal with that. You can't just ignore it and, you know, shove it under the rug. We have pains in healthcare. Cancer is a huge one. We have pains in our society, which means, like, you know, big companies have all the technology and the small and medium businesses, family businesses suffer because they don't have the capital or access to the technology that the big guys do. And so they're always under the thumb of big agriculture or big energy or what have you. How can we now use technology, because it's now being democratized, to rise up these small and medium businesses, family businesses, and they can work in maybe even better ways than the big incumbents that are already there, and we can unseat them. So I'm always looking for the pain where there's an underserved category of people who want to do something and be empowered, but couldn't for the longest time. But now, because the technology is available on their smartphone, there's mobile data networks everywhere, there's new forms of financing and ways of getting it paid for, that they can now adopt this technology and compete with or compete better than the big guys that are too dumb and slow and fat and happy to, you know, to actually address the change that they need to make the planet better.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course, that's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the US have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Fonny Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Fonny Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Fonny Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Fonny Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. So tell me, if we just try this out for just a minute, how do you help people clarify what's possible in their life? I think your book is where you're trying, is your best attempt at doing that right now.
Well, the first one is be the change you wish to see. So I don't drink. I haven't drank for 15 years. So I'm a vegetarian. I try to do the right things by the climate, all this other stuff. I try not to overconsume, even though I could, because it's easy when you have the resources. So I try to stay within bounds, right? And try to be that change. And I see people around me, my friends and everything, who thought I was crazy. And now all of a sudden they're like, I'll give it a try. And they're like, oh, I like this. And like, oh, you know, I always was the odd guy out. But, you know, if you live to what you think. So one is to live the way you think you should live is in harmony, and people will follow. Then there's the book, which is giving back, right? Truly giving back. The only reason why I'm here talking to you today is because I had mentors who helped me get here. It wasn't because I just was the smartest guy. It was because people called bullshit on me. People I trusted called bullshit on me and helped me get there. And so I wrote the book to honor those mentors, to say, most of them had died, I was like, wait a second. Oh, the baton, as you said, has been passed to me. Now I have to give back, because that is the cycle of life. And so through the book, it's that. But I also look at, you know, there's other things that we have to fight for people who are self-actualized, which is the overconsumption of marketing, the brainwashing through highly targeted social media and the like, media in general, clickbait. We need to fight against that stuff. And there's some of us who live outside the system who can do that. And I try to do that. I try to be very vocal about that stuff. Like, I don't believe in the metaverse. I don't believe it. I think it's horrible for humans. We haven't seen any disintermediation between human connection that has actually turned out to be anything positive. It's all been more or less toxic. Look at comments in chats, in chat rooms. If you're anonymous, what happens? When you can lose the connection, when I can see your eyes and I can make that connection, I'm not going to say the same things I would say to you if there's just, you're a graphical character, or you're just text or whatever. You're not going to say those things. Toxicity grows when there's a lack of human connection, but you can still have communication. Okay. So I think it's incumbent upon the people who are outside of the system or who run the systems to stand up for this human connection and these things. So when you talk about depression, you talk about these kinds of things, why did they start? It's because people are getting these bad things in their brain from somewhere. Obviously, it could be family. It could be their environments, but also their digital environments can be feeding them. I've seen digital addiction firsthand. I see what it does to people. I've seen people go through digital detox programs. And when I saw what the iPhone and its, you know, it was like, and how kids were getting in trouble because we didn't have the tools to really monitor and control our digital consumption like we do for our physical consumption, like a scale, you know, nutritional facts, all of these things. We need the same thing for our digital life. So I went out and spoke up hard. People at Apple didn't like me for it. They were like, why are you doing this? I'm like, because you're not doing the right thing. You're not doing the right thing for our societies. You need to have healthy customers to have a healthy business. And if you're treating the customers wrong and they're being unhealthy, you're not going to be around for as long as you should be. So I think that, you know, things like you were talking about, which is, you know, trying to make these things available, these tools available. I think there is a new generation of people who want these tools. They want digital control over their digital life. They don't want to be surveilled all the time and their data taken, and they want the tools to help deprogram them from, and the brainwashing from, a lot of the stuff they might have grew up with. And so I think that, you know, the tools like what we're doing now, we're creating this content, getting it out to people at scale, needs to happen. I would love to see the digital device purveyors out there make sure that digital health comes part of the set of applications that they're default apps that you come when you get your iPhone. It's right there. You don't have to download it. It's right there and says, here, let me tell you the best ways to, you know, to avoid digital addiction and the rules of there. Why do we have to go search it? Just like you have warning signs on freaking smoking and cigarettes. Why do we have warning signs on this stuff? Right? Not that it has to be so, you know, like we see with smoking, but at least give people the tools and making them so easy and tell them about the dangers so they can make better choices.
How do you build practices for your family and yourself working with the digital world and some of the products that, you know, you're responsible for their birth of?
Yeah, I'm very clear about no devices at the tables. Have human connection. Don't even put the device on the table. Put it in, not even in your pocket. I don't want to see it buzzing. And don't turn off all notifications, much to the chagrin of my wife and kids, because I don't get their messages immediately and I don't respond immediately. You know, I grew up in a world where we didn't respond immediately, right? We didn't know where everybody was at every single time. Now we worry about, oh my God, where's the next step the kid's taking? We were out on the streets doing whatever it was, right? And now all of a sudden we're hyper digital leashes for everyone. We need to start understanding that we can live that way. We've gotten so sensitized that we need these things to actually feel good, but it actually creates more nervousness as opposed to more confidence in our environments around us, that they're not toxic and kids aren't going to be, you know, swept up off the street and these kinds of things. So I think we need to find a new way. The pendulum swung to, you got to need to know where everybody is at all the time and message everyone and get notifications and respond right away. We need to find a nice balance here. And so by turning off notifications, by putting away the devices, by making sure they're not next to your bedside every night, like a bottle of alcohol. Would you leave a bottle of alcohol next to your kid's bed and say, oh, I trust that they're not going to drink it? Would you leave a bottle of alcohol next to your bed? No. So why do you have that? A digital version of it next to your bed.
Yeah. Okay. And then clear. And then do you have, those are great practices. Do you do anything to counter rotate the digital world? So those are like practical practices. And I'm wondering if you do it, any sort of, let's call it exercise or meditation or being outside.
I'm CrossFit. I'm on my bike. I'm running. I'm doing yoga. I'm hiking. Right, I'm doing all these different outdoor sports, but I will only take a digital device with me for security, but I will not use it in any way. I will not have music. I will not have a podcast on. I won't do anything. I want that stuff away because this is my moving meditation time.
Mm. So no music when you're running or?
No, absolutely not. Because one, it's dangerous. Because you don't have your picking up, but I'm also not getting the nature signals into my brain to help me to navigate my surroundings and understand fight or flight, right? And is something coming up behind me? I also find that the best time when I come up with my ideas, when I'm really working with hard problems, is when I'm on a 4-hour bike ride and I'm sitting there and all of a sudden I'm not thinking about it, but all of a sudden the answers start dropping in and I'm like, oh my God, where is these things coming from? And I don't know if it's just me, but I always find when you get rid of the distractions, the attention distractions, and get clarity, not just when you're sleeping, but clarity of mind when you're doing something, get in the flow of doing something, all of a sudden it relieves the stress on the brain of ruminating on something. And then it naturally pops in, at least to my brain. And the amount of ideas or resolutions to problems that I find when I'm not being bombarded, my attention being bombarded, is amazing. So I learned this long time ago. People are like, you don't run with an iPad? I'm like, no. But you can run 30% better with music. I'm like, yes, but that's not the point. The point is to get moving meditation, not to be, you know, the fastest, you know, marathoner.
I mean, it's not lost on me that the father of the iPod does not use or listen to music while he's working out. Like, there's no loss of irony there.
Yeah, it's true. You got to have your own time away from all this stuff.
Okay. Okay. And then what you're talking about, we've talked about this so much in this community about signal to noise ratio, is making sure that you're working to get to the signal.
Right.
And it's the only chance you have to work with all of the noise of the world. The internal noise, the external noise for sure, is to be connected to the signal. And correct. If you don't have a practice to get to the signal, I think you're not even in the fucking game.
You want to hear my way to find signal?
Yeah.
Is by listening to a lot of noise.
What?
So I look at between 800 to 1,000 headlines a day. I look at 800 and maybe out of those, I see 20 to 30 that are interesting. Okay. And each day I look at a lot of noise. And then when I see enough of the same things popping up in my stream from all kinds of different things, it becomes a signal.
Oh my God. How do you do that? Why? What?
I have an RSS reader that comes up with all the things and I go click, click, save this. Nope. Bat, 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 bat. And I just read the headline and maybe the first two sentences of the text. And from that, I can already know what I'm tuning into because I care about climate health and societal changes. I care about certain things that are my hobbies. And through that, I'm like, bat, bat, yes, yes, yes. And maybe I'll get 20 articles out of those 1,000 each day that I'll actually read. But I've also got the noise of all those articles, and it's there. It's just simmering below the surface. And then the next day, I see a couple more articles that have similar words. And then the next day, and the next week, I'm like, oh, maybe I better pay attention to this.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it feels right? Like it's like, so I think of you as a visionary technologist, you know, like. Deep innovator, deep tech type of stuff. And obviously you're mentoring so many people and companies, you know, from your fund. But then that seems so, that seems like somebody's picking up 15 newspapers, you know, 20 years ago and saying, I'm just reading all the headlines.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like if there's something.
But how do you get to the edge? So I'm reading research papers. I'm reading the headlines from research papers. There's summaries of research papers. I'm reading about fashion. I'm reading about news in Southeast Asia. I'm reading about politics in, you know, out of the FT. And so I get enough of these things because you need to find where the problem space are and where new technologies and kind of movements are happening. So just kind of like what I was doing, like when I was a kid in school, watching. That's the same. I'm just watching. And then sooner or later, I'm like, things start dropping.
What do you say to yourself that like is really harsh? Like the things you wish your kids would never say to themselves about themselves.
What do I say to myself that's harsh?
Yeah. Like what is, I want to know what that inner, because you've got an inner critic too. I haven't heard it yet. Yeah. So what is that inner critic? And then how do you work with it?
Well, first, my inner critic is when something didn't go to what I, you know, my opinion or my gut, and then you tear it apart and you try to analyze and learn from it because that's a failure, right? So you need to learn from it and then pick it up. Like to me, remember, 80 to 85% of all of my investments fail. So 50 out of 100% of investments, 15 maybe 20% are good investments. The other 80% fail. So I'm failing all the time. And so when I fail in a space, I'm like, why did that fail? Da, 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 da. Oh, it failed for these reasons. Okay, now let's invest in the space again in a new way.
But so that's not an inner critic. That is like being critical. That's doing critical thinking.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you like say things to yourself, because I'm not getting a sense of it, which means that it might not be prevalent for you. It might not be an issue. Do you say things to yourself like
imposter syndrome?
Okay. Like, how do you say that to yourself? Like, how does just that go, actually sound?
How the hell did I get here? Why am I here? Why is it me? Like, why should I be doing these things? Why do people care about what I say, like in the book and all that stuff? I was really worried about writing that book. And actually in April, I was scared shitless because I pulled back the veneer. I was totally raw and vulnerable. And I, you know, when you read the book, I think it comes across like I was saying stuff that I wouldn't even tell most people, but I was telling it on a scale that was much larger because I said, this needs to be told and I need to resolve it for myself because it was catharsis for me.
So I needed, how do you work from the inside? Like, is it writing, meditation? Is it therapy? Is it a wisdom counsel that you have? Is it
So one is having mentors around me or having other people who were kind of peers who can really call me on my shit. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have my kids.
Truth tellers.
Yeah. Just like, oh, really got me, man. For Build, I had a co-writer, Dina Levinsky, and you know, she was with me since the early Nest days. She'd call me on my shit. I'd call her on her shit. So we were always battling it out throughout the book because she saw a lot of this stuff. You know, I also get very quiet sometimes when I know I'm not doing the right thing. And I then talk to some friends about it and just go, hey, well, here's what I'm thinking. And this is what I'm feeling. Because to me, when I know a conversation goes awry, I feel it so viscerally that it doesn't leave me for days. And so through that, I have to then, I feel guilt, some weird guilt. And maybe it's because I was Catholic. I feel this guilt and I'm like, if I don't resolve this, this is going to hang with me for a long time. And because I ruminate, like I shouldn't have said that. And I'm like, okay, how's the best way to come back and apologize or look, reframe it? Or what was I really trying to say here? You know, like in the book, the assholes chapter was rewritten 8 times because there was so much emotion to finally tear down to get to what the points were. Or fuck massages, that chapter. How do we get to the real core of what I'm trying to say and strip away the emotion and get to that? Because I have so much emotion, you know, and so many gut instincts that sometimes it doesn't come out clearly, you know, because I know what I want to say, but it comes out emotionally instead of rationally and distilled down. So I have this kind of inner sense in me that I think I did wrong. I check it outside and then I go, okay, what can I learn from that? So it retrains my brain so I don't do it again. And also try to do the healing if there was any trauma that I created in others. Hmm.
Yeah, I imagine, like, you know, you've broken some glass. You've got an energy about you that is compelling, exciting. There's a lot of intensity.
And it's a double-edged sword, man.
That's, yeah. How have you done well in your life with relationships?
Look, I'm working with people that I worked with 30 years ago. We work every day together. So without a doubt, because of relationships are not transactions. Right. And you go through the ebb and flow, the ups and the downs, and you help people a lot. I try to help people. And I've always learned that if I help people, I don't look for a quid pro quo. Usually comes back to me 10x bigger than I ever thought. Right. So the more I pay it forward, if that's the right term for it, I've always seen it come back to me in some ways. And that's either whether it's advice, good advice that I give, or connections or linking people up. Or whether it's I give the hard advice, the truth, and people hate you for it. And they might hate you for 5 or 10 years, but then they come back. And I've had so many emails from people going, I hated working for you. You pushed me. You were just a complete, and for me, mission-driven asshole. But you know what? You pushed me beyond my limits. You saw something in me I didn't see. And you made me make myself become a better person because you wouldn't let me just skirt by. That's when I know that I'm doing the right thing and I'm doing it for the right reasons, even though it could be, I have to soften it. But when you say those truths, hopefully in a nice way that can be, it resonates with the person, even though it's hard to hear, it comes back tenfold later because who knows you know, what it is, because that's when you show you care. That's caring, is giving people time and your advice and trying to help, right? Even if it hurts at certain times.
So on this blend between people and purpose, or people and mission and vision, can I wonder if you could pull me into the first 100 days at Nest. And
sure,
my working thesis is that in those first 100 days, you can't win, but you can definitely lose. You can lose your people, you can lose your money, you can lose the vision, you can lose your way. And so can you pull me in to help me understand, from those first 100 days, what are some of the most important lessons that you could share with other folks that are starting anything new, whether it be a new company or a new family, or they're now a mom or dad or a parent for the first time? The first 100 days at Nest as a framework.
So the first 100 days, so before, there's the kind of the official date of when it started versus the buildup to it. So let's talk about the 100 days around, not just after the say we're going to do it, but up to it. So it was me discovering the pains out in the world. I had already been feeling the pains for about 5-6 years. And then I was like, okay, now it's time. I'm going to take up this pain and I'm going to see if I can make a painkiller. So I started looking at the business, reading online, all this other stuff. Then I pulled in a person, Larry Gusson. Larry, I'd known since college. He'd always call me on my shit. He was a researcher. He would like be all over the place. And Larry, I'm like, Larry, can you help me with some research on this thing? Because he was always just very clear cut. He's like, sure, I'll help you. And then he's like, oh, I have this other woman. She just graduated. We could bring her on too. And she didn't know anything about the space. So I'm like, sure, bring her on if you think she's great. Okay. So, and then I brought on, then I talked to Matt Rogers, and I gave him the idea. And I started pitching him the idea. He's like, oh my God, that's great. I need to do this. And then he started going every day, like, we got to do this thing together. Then I started telling other smart people around me of the idea. And they were like, yes, that was good. And this was people who I knew for 15 or 20 years at General Magic, and said, yes, I want to join this. And there was other people who said, are you crazy? Are you nuts? This is the stupidest idea ever. The iPod guy should be doing this, right? But I started building this team around this mission of, you know, the, you know, saving energy. It was really about saving energy and being more comfortable and saving money and doing it in a way to help the planet overall. And so that was the mission. And people were joining the mission. And it got stronger and stronger. And we changed things and we kept changing things. And this little team just kept building and building, you know, the ideas and throwing things overboard and adding new things and trying and changing. Then I would go out to, again, more friends as it got better and said secretly, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing. And one person said, hey, I'll write you a check right away. I'd love to invest in this, right? And then when I asked another person, because at this point, now this is, Nest is different because it wasn't the early part of my career. I didn't have all the success in my, this is a later part of my career. So everyone's like, anything that Tony's doing, I want to be involved in, is usually how it goes now. And so that's, it's kind of difficult sometimes to always get true feelings about what I'm trying to do. But, you know, I surround myself with people who will call me on my craft. So more and more people were joining this thing and it was becoming this movement. And at some point I was just like, I got to do this. Who is going to do this? Like, nothing out there even addresses half the things we're trying to do, solves the problems we're doing. And who else is going to be crazy enough to invest in a small team building a thermostat, right? Internet connected. So it's like, and this is going to really help the planet and change the way people think about things and help. I'm like, shit, I got to do this now. The money's coming. The people are showing up. The mission's coming together. It's like, okay. And I just had to throw myself into it. And that's how it really started. And then after that, the snowball just kept rolling downhill and growing bigger and bigger and bigger. So, but I think that anybody who has a really good mission and enough smart people around them can do the same thing. Maybe it'll be a little bit more difficult. Remember, this was 2010, just after 2008 financial crisis, right? And so it wasn't like it was the best of times. It was not necessarily good, especially for anybody doing climate technology. But we found the right people and the people who really want to support the mission, and they got behind us. So the first 100 days was just forming that team, getting the people around you, whittling away and strengthening your stories, and saying, we don't know everybody, everything, but would you help, right? Too many people, when they're on a mission or on a building something, they think they have to know everything. They don't ask for enough help. So it was asking for help, getting people involved. What do you see? And again, owning that idea, giving that idea up to people, saying, what do you see? What do you see? What can we do? How can we make it, test it, make it better? So it was all of those things. It's that kind of petri dish of different ideas, all fighting it out and coming together to form a bigger organism.
Very cool. Thank you. I mean, feel the pain, clarify a solution, clarify a mission.
Understand the why resonates with other people and be able to communicate the why.
And then that's where you start to, you're asking for help, which is really the people part. There's the vulnerability that you share in that, which is remarkable and noted. And the why thing that came from Steve Jobs is if I understand.
The storytelling of why I saw on display at Steve, he was a master at it. And then we took it to a whole nother level at Nest and codified it and made sure we understood it from every single aspect of customer touch points of the customer journey and broadened it further than Steve had. Yeah, I'm sure it was in his brain, but we actually made it like almost a Bible for how we went off and thought about problems and how to solve them and make sure we were resonating at we engineered marketing. If that makes any sense, we literally had an engineering process for how to do messaging and marketing so that we made sure that we were not losing the plot at every single touch point along that customer journey. And that's all in the book.
When did you sell Nest? What year?
End of 2014.
So I worked with your senior leadership team. And I think
what year?
What after you sold? I was in my head, I can go look, but I think it was like, I thought it was 2015, 16.
Okay.
Like they were switched on. I remember we did some stuff to help them get out of their comfort zone. they swallowed it. Like they went for it. It was a lot of fun. And so, but I think it was after, I'm sure there was a lot of changes after you left, but I don't know how involved you are in like 2015, 2016.
2015, I was there. 2016, I was wrapping up. So, but you know, when you have a team that wants to learn and to do better, that's amazing. And we wanted to make sure that we were growing the team as we grew, so that we were growing from the inside and growing the individuals, because the more that those individuals believe the mission and they believe that you're supporting them and you're trying to grow them, not everyone grows with the team, but if enough people are growing with it, you create this culture that's like, I wouldn't go anywhere else, and this is something I want to do. And that's when they see something better, they don't get defensive. They're like, they devour and say, what else can we do? Because they want to raise the bar for themselves and the whole team. And that's the most rewarding thing. You can build products, but building cultures and teams that last. And this is like general magic. We are still together. Most of us are still together as best friends 30 years later. The Nest team, the same thing. And they go off to do their own startups. Now there's a bunch of ex-nesters who created startups out, and they're recreating those teams and those cultures and taking and making even what we built and those processes even better. And that's what's beautiful. So you don't just build a product or you don't just build a service, but you build a mentality, a mindset, a way of working, and a network of people like that, so you can continue generation after generation to do that. To me, that's your soul. I don't believe in the ethereal soul. I believe your soul is what you plant in each person on this planet, and they remember you even when you're gone, and they live and take those things that you imparted to them and build on top of it. And instill it into the next generations and the next generations and the next generations. That is a person's soul. That's what people remember.
So the next big mission, speaking about like making a difference in people and illuminating something special, is about environment and climate change.
Yes.
And what... not only are you just donating the proceeds from the book that you wrote, Build, but you're going to 5x whatever the book makes. If it makes a million, you're going to donate 5 million to what fund are you supporting?
So it's the Build Climate Fund. And that's going to be run by my team and I. going out, and because that's what we do every day, is find these businesses and back them. And then as they grow and we help them, we mentor them. And if there's any profits and proceeds from that, we put it back into the build fund to go back out again. So it's an evergreen fund that keeps rolling the money through. And then ultimately any profits that we see are going to go to climate focused philanthropic funds. So there's no money that's going to come back to the team or I in terms of like big windfalls. What this is supposed to be is an evergreen fund to continue this culture, this creation of generational companies that can help our planet and sustain it. Because even if we get to 2015, we're going to need more things after that, because we're going to continue to grow and build on this planet. So that's my hope with the outcome of this book, is that a lot of great entrepreneurs doing really hard things, or people inside of big companies doing really hard things, get inspired by the book, learn some things to use those tools so that we can then make the money, 5X match the money, and then continue to create more and more and more. So that it becomes a real movement, not just of one team, but a whole set of teams and a whole set of people who can then go off and change the world on mass everywhere on the planet.
So you buy the book, Build. And not only do you get 30 years of insights and best practices in digestible, snackable bits of powerful information, but you also are putting 5X that back into the climate. That's a win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win. I like win-win-wins. When that happens, you know, magic can happen.
It's awesome. Tony, thank you. I feel like I could spend so much time with you, but you know, like I bet a lot of people feel that way about you. Thank you for making a difference in the planet. Thank you for making a difference in our community. And I feel more switched on and inspired after having this conversation with you. And so thank you.
Mike, thank you for doing what you do. Thanks for teaching people to try to find their mastery, finding like some way, something that moves them, because it takes all of us working together to help, you know, make movements. So you do what you do at your level. I do what I do at my level. And it takes all of us and all the teamwork, wherever you are, to be able to change this planet for the better. So thank you for doing what you do. And thank you for having me on the show. And I hope the listeners had learned something from this and can take this on and build great things and change the world for the better.
It's awesome knowing you're on the planet doing what you're doing. And so again, I feel everything you just said, gratefully appreciating it. And again, Tony, thank you. I hope our paths cross in person soon.
Absolutely. And they did it, Ness. I'm sure there's more things we can do together. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can manifest together.
Come on, Tony. Let's go.
All right.
But I appreciate
peace,
you.
Peace, man.
Okay. You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.